67. Spiridon. Round-headed Spiridon, on whose face only a practiced eye could distinguish respect from mockery, had aroused Nyazin's interest as soon as he arrived in the Sharashka. There had been carpenters and mechanics and turners there before him, but Spiridon's unspoiled naturalness made him different. Here, without a doubt, was a representative of the people on whose wisdom Nyazin could draw. He felt, however, a certain awkwardness. He could find no excuse for getting to know Spiridon more closely. He had, at first, nothing to talk to him about. They did not meet at work, and they lived in different parts of the prison. The small group of manual labourers lived in a separate room, and spent their leisure hours apart from other prisoners, so that when Nyazin started visiting Spiridon, they all, Spiridon among them, decided that he was a wolf on the prowl, seeking prey for the Godfather. Spiridon considered himself the least important person in the Sharashka, and could not imagine why operations officers should be targeting him. But since they turned up their noses at no carrion, he had to be on his guard. When Nyazin came into the room, Spiridon would light up with pretended joy, make room for him on the bunk, and, with a stupid look on his face, start talking about something a million miles from politics. How to catch a spawning fish with a spike, or catch it by the gills with a forked stick in still water, or lure it into a net. How he had hunted elk and brown bears. But better steer clear of the black bear with a white tie. How lungwort is used to get rid of snakes, while the woodpecker herb is mighty good for mowing. Then there was the long story of his courtship of Marfa Ustinovna in the 20s, when she belonged to the drama group at the village club. Her parents wanted to marry her off to a rich miller, but she loved Spiridon and eloped with him, and they were secretly married on St. Peter's Day. While Spiridon was telling him all this, those sore eyes hardly moved. They seemed to say from under his bushy ginger eyebrows, "Why do you keep coming here, wolf? You can see for yourself you'll get slim pickings." In fact, any stoolie would have despaired long ago and abandoned this uncooperative victim. Nobody could have been so curious about Spiridon's hunting career as to come along and listen patiently to his revelations every Sunday evening. But Nyazin, who, to begin with, felt shy when he looked in on Spiridon, was also the Nyazin with an insatiable longing to solve, here in prison, problems he had not thought through as a free man. He kept it up month after month, and far from wearying of Spiridon's stories, felt refreshed by them. They were like the breath of a river at dawn, like the breeze that freshens a field in the afternoon, and they took him back to that unique 7 years in the life of Russia, the 7 years of the new economic policy, the equal and the like of which Russia had never known from the time of the first clearings in the primeval forest, long before the coming of Rurik's men, to the most recent disamalgamation of collective farms. Nyazin had caught a glimpse of that time while he was still too young to understand, and he greatly regretted not having been born a bit earlier. Abandoning himself to Spiridon's warm, husky voice, Nyazin never once tried to trick him into talking about politics. So Spiridon gradually began to trust him, and plunged into the past without being forced to it. He was no longer inhibited by constant wariness. The deep furrows in his brow disappeared, and a quiet smile played on his ruddy face. Only his impaired eyesight prevented Spiridon from reading in the Sharashka. Occasionally, in an attempt to adapt his own speech to Nyazin's, he would work in words such as principle, period, and analogously, usually in the wrong place. In the days when Marfa Ustinovna had performed with the village drama circle, he had heard the name Yesenin from the stage, and it had remained in his memory. "Yesenin?" Nyazin said in surprise. "Great stuff. I've got his poems here in the Sharashka. They're hard to come by nowadays." And he took along the little book in a jacket carpeted with embossed autumn maple leaves. Could it be that a miracle was about to happen, he wondered. Would the semi-literate Spiridon understand Yesenin? No miracle took place. Spiridon didn't remember a line of what he had heard. But he greatly enjoyed Tanyusha was oh so pretty, and threshing. 2 days later, Major Shikin called Nyazin in and ordered him to hand over Yesenin for sensorial inspection. Nerjen never discovered who had informed on him. But now that he had clearly been victimized by the Godfather and lost his Yesenin, more or less because of Spiridon, Gleb was finally seen to be trustworthy. Spiridon began to talk to him as an equal and a friend, and their conversations no longer took place in the room but under the stairs inside the main prison building, where nobody could hear them. On the last 5 or 6 Sunday evenings, Spiridon's stories had given Nerjen glimpses of the profundity for which he had longed. The life of a Russian peasant, indistinguishable from millions of others, who had been 17 in the year of the revolution, and just over 40 when the war with Hitler began, unfolded before Nerjen's eyes. Hurricanes had raged around him. He had become head of the family at 14. His father was called up for the war with Germany and killed in action, and had gone out to mow with the old men.
"I learned to use a scythe in half a day."
At 16 he was employed in a glassworks and marching to open-air meetings under red banners, when it was announced that the land now belonged to the peasants. Spiridon rushed back to his village and took a plot. That year he and his mother, younger brother and sisters strained every sinew, and by the feast of the Protectress they had corn for the winter. But after Christmas the authorities started forcibly exacting all the grain they could for the towns. "Come on, hand it over. More, more, more." Then, after Easter, Spiridon's year was called up, the 18s, and he'd just turned 19. The Red Army was about to grab him. But Spiridon saw no advantage in leaving his land for the army, so he and some of the other village lads took off into the woods and became greens. "Leave us alone and we'll leave you alone." Later on, though, it wasn't safe even out in the woods, so they went over to the Whites, who had popped up briefly in their district. The Whites interrogated them, wanted to know if there was a commissar among them. There was no commissar, so the Whites knocked the ringleader on the head to encourage the others, made them wear tricolour cockades, and gave them rifles. The Whites generally did things in the old way, as under the Tsar. After they'd fought for the Whites a bit, Spiridon and his comrades were taken prisoner by the Reds. They didn't put up much resistance. In fact, they gave themselves up. The Reds shot the officers and ordered the rankers to remove the cockades from their caps and put on armbands. Spiridon remained with the Reds till the end of the Civil War. He had fought in Poland, too, and after that his unit had become part of the Labour Army. He had thought he would never get home. Then at Shrovetide they were taken to Petersburg and, in the first week of Lent, marched across the sea over the ice to capture some fortress. Only then did Spiridon manage to get home. He returned to his village in the spring and eagerly set to work on the patch of land he had fought to make his own. Others came back from the war, work-shy and all talk, but not Spiridon. He quickly put his holding on a firm footing. A good husbandman can walk down the yard and pick up a ruble. Married, and got himself some horses. The government itself was of two minds at the time. It looked to the poorer peasants for support, but nobody wanted to join the ranks of the poor. Those peasants who liked work were eager to better themselves. A new word was borne in on the breeze, intensifier. It meant anyone who wanted to get the best out of his farm without hired labour, relying on science and native wit. With his wife's help, Spiridon Yegorov became an intensifier.
"A good wife makes all the difference in life," Spiridon always said.
Marfa Ustinovna was the joy of his life. Marrying her was the luckiest thing he ever did. Because of her, he did not drink and hang around with idlers. She had borne him 3 children in successive years, 2 sons and then a daughter, but still pulled her weight side by side with her husband, and their holding had flourished. She was literate. She read a magazine called Be Your Own Agronomist, and that was how Spiridon became an intensifier. Intensifiers were made a fuss over. Spiridon and Marfa were given subsidies and seed. They went from strength to strength, from well-off to better-off, and began to think of building themselves a brick house, not knowing that their good fortune was about to run out. Spiridon was generally respected. He sat on the platform at meetings as a Civil War hero, and by now a party member. At that point their home was completely destroyed by fire. They barely managed to rescue the children. They were left with nothing. But they were given little time to grieve. They had scarcely begun to struggle to their feet after the fire when a thunderclap came from distant Moscow. The intensifiers unthinkingly fostered by Moscow, were now just as unthinkingly rechristened kulaks and weeded out. Marfa and Spiridon were glad that they had not got around to building their brick house. Fate had played one of its favourite tricks, and their misfortune proved to be a blessing. Spiridon Yegorov might easily have been marched off by the GPU to die in the tundra, but instead he was appointed commissar for collectivization to herd the people into collective farms. He took to wearing a military revolver on his hip, personally evicted people from their houses, and sent them off under police escort, empty-handed, without belongings, kulaks and non-kulaks alike. Spiridon's behaviour at this and at other critical moments in his career defied easy explanation or class analysis. Nerzhin did not reproach him, not wanting to reopen old wounds, and anyway it was easy to see that all this had left Spiridon troubled at heart. He had started drinking, and drank as though the whole village had once been his, and now he was messing up everything. He had accepted the rank of commissar, but neglected his duties. He turned a blind eye to the peasants who killed off their beasts, and entered the kolkhoz without hoof or horn to their name. For all of this, Spiridon was dismissed, and they did not stop at that. He was ordered to put his hands behind his back, and two militiamen, one behind and one in front, revolvers drawn, marched him off to jail. He was tried quickly. In our whole period, they've never wasted time trying people. Given 10 years for economic counter-revolution, and sent off to the White Sea Canal, and after that was finished, to the Moscow-Volga Canal. There, Spiridon worked at times as a manual labourer, and at times as a carpenter. He got good rations, and it was only for Marfa, left behind with their 3 children, that his heart ached. But then Spiridon's case was reopened. The charge of economic counter-revolution was changed to dereliction of duty, and as a result he became a class ally instead of a class enemy. He was called in and informed that he would now be entrusted with a rifle to stand guard over his fellow prisoners. Only yesterday, Spiridon, like any decent zek, had abused the escort troops with the vilest of language, and the convicts among them with words even stronger. But he now took the proffered rifle and marched out his comrades of yesterday under escort, because this shortened the term of his imprisonment and gave him 40 rubles a month to send home. Before long, the camp commandant was congratulating him on his release. Spiridon got his documents made out, not for a kolkhoz, but for a factory at Pochep. He collected Marfa and the children, and was soon appearing on the factory honours board as one of the best glassblowers. He did all the overtime he could to recoup his losses from the fire. Husband and wife began to think about a little cottage with a garden and further schooling for their children. The children were 15, 14, and 13 when the war broke out. The front moved quickly toward the settlement in which they lived. The authorities evacuated everybody they could to the east, the whole population of Pochep included. At every turning point in Spiridon's life story, Nerzhin awaited the next surprise with bated breath. He half expected to hear that Spiridon, resenting as he must his years in camp, had stayed behind to await the Germans. Not at all. Spiridon had behaved at first as people do in the best patriotic novels. He buried his belongings, and as soon as the factory equipment was evacuated by rail and the workers given carts, he put his wife and 3 children on one of them, and, "It isn't my horse and it isn't my whip, so off we go and I'll never say whoa," retreated from Pochep all the way to Kaluga, with thousands of others. But near Kaluga something went wrong, and their column broke up. There were now only hundreds of them, rather than thousands. Moreover, the men were to be enlisted at the first recruiting office along the route, and their families sent on without them. As soon as it became clear that he faced separation from his family, sure as ever that he was doing the right thing, Spiridon took to the woods, waited till the front had rolled past, put his family on the same old cart, pulled by the same horse, except that it was no longer state property but his very own to keep, and took them all the way back to Pochep, and from there to his native village, where he settled in a deserted hut. He was told to take as much of the former kolkhoz land as he could, and to work it. Spiridon ploughed and sowed with no qualms of conscience, ignoring the war bulletins, working steadily and confidently, as though he was back in the far-off years when there was no kolkhoz and no war. Partisans came to him and said, "Pull yourself together, Spiridon. You should be fighting, not ploughing. Somebody has to plough. Spiridon answered, and refused to leave the land. They tried to force people to join the partisans. As he explained it now, it wasn't enough that young and old would just as soon be creeping up on the Germans, knife between teeth, as sit at home chewing their crusts. No, what happened was that instructors from Moscow were parachuted in to drive the peasants out with threats or fatally compromise them. The partisans managed to kill a German dispatch rider right in the middle of the village. They knew the German rules. The Germans drove in immediately, turned the people out of their houses, and burned the whole village to the ground. Once again, Spiridon did not hesitate. The time had come to settle accounts with the Germans. He took Marfa and the children to her mother and hurried off to join the same group of partisans in the forest. He was given an automatic rifle, and working just as conscientiously and methodically as he had in the factory and on the land, he picked off Germans patrolling the railway line, attacked convoys, helped to blow up bridges, and visited his family at holiday times. In spite of everything, he still had his family. But the front was rolling back their way. They flattered themselves that Spiridon would get a partisan medal when Soviet troops arrived. It was even announced that partisans would be incorporated into the regular army, and that their days in the forest would soon be over. Then a lad came running with the news that the Germans had moved all the inhabitants from the village where Marfa was living. Spiridon was not waiting for the Red Army or for anything else. Without a word to anyone, he abandoned his gun and his two drums of ammunition and rushed off to find his family. He merged with the flood of displaced people, pretending to be a civilian, walking beside the same old cart, flicking the same little horse with his whip. Sure as always that he was doing what was right and proper, he trudged along the congested road from Pochep to Slutsk. Nerzhin clutched his head and rocked from side to side. "Dear, oh dear, oh dear! What extraordinary things you tell me, Spiridon Danilich! I can't take it all in. You went over the ice to Kronstadt. You were one of those who set up this Soviet regime of ours. You forced people into the collective farms. Well, didn't you help to set it up?" Nerzhin was at a loss for an answer. The conventional view was that his father's generation had established the regime, and that in 1917, at that solemn moment, every one of those heroes clearly realized what he was doing. The smile on Spiridon's lips grew broader. "You helped set it up, all right. Didn't you realize?" "No, I didn't," Nerzhin whispered, going over in his mind his 3 years as an officer at the front. "Well, it's like that sometimes. We plant rye, and what comes up is goose grass." But Nerzhin wanted to get on with his sociological investigation. "What happened next, Spiridon Danilich?" What happened next? He could, of course, have made a break for the forest yet again. He tried it once, but there was a hair-raising encounter with bandits, and he narrowly saved his daughter from them. So he stayed with the column. Besides, he had begun to realize that the Soviet authorities would not believe him, would remember that he hadn't joined the partisans right away and that he had deserted. He decided that he might as well be hanged for a sheep as for a lamb, and went all the way to Slutsk. There they were put on trains and given food coupons to last them as far as the Rhineland. At first the whisper went around that children could not be taken, and Spiridon started looking for a chance to turn back. But everyone was accepted, so he abandoned his horse and cart without a second thought and joined the train. He and the two boys were assigned to a factory near Mainz, and his wife and daughter were sent to work for farmers. One day at the factory, a German foreman struck Spiridon's younger son. Without stopping to think, Spiridon jumped up and threatened the foreman with an axe. Under German law, Spiridon could have been shot. But the foreman calmed down, went up to the mutineer, and, as Spiridon now told the story, said, "I, myself, Vater, I, you, Verstehe." He did not report the matter, and Spiridon learned soon afterward that the foreman had that very morning received notification of his son's death in Russia. Remembering that foreman in the Rhineland, the case-hardened Spiridon was not ashamed to wipe a tear away with his sleeve. "Since then I've never been angry with the Germans. They burned my house down and did all those other bad things, but that Vater wiped the slate clean. He had a heart, that man. There's another sort of German for you." That was one of the rare, the very rare, events, to shake the red-headed peasant's dogged certainty that he was always right. Otherwise, through all the difficult years, through all the cruel vicissitudes, self-doubt had never unmanned Spiridon at the decisive moment. Spiridon Yegorov was horrifyingly ignorant. His mind was closed to the highest creations of the human spirit and human society, but his actions and decisions were marked by a steady and unwavering common sense. For instance, knowing that the Germans would have shot all the village dogs, he calmly buried the severed head of a cow in light snow, something he would never have done ordinarily. Needless to say, he had never studied geography or German, but when they were digging trenches in Alsace and things started getting rough, to top it all, the Americans were raining down bombs on them, he took his older son and ran away. He couldn't read German signs or ask anyone the way. He lay low in the daytime and travelled only by night over unknown country, as the crow flies, avoiding roads, covered 90 kilometres, and crept from house to house till he found the farm near Mainz where his wife was working. There he and his son holed up in a bunker in the orchard until the Americans arrived. Spiridon had never been teased by any of the eternally unanswerable questions. Whether sensory perception supplies true knowledge, whether we are capable of knowing things in themselves. He was sure that he saw, smelled, and understood things without possibility of error. Spiridon's moral code was just as uncomplicated and quietly confident. He spoke ill of no one. He never bore false witness. He used foul language only when necessary. He killed only when at war. He had got into fights only for his bride. He wouldn't steal a crumb or a rag from any other person, but he robbed the state whenever opportunity offered, with a cool conviction that it was right. He had, as he said, sampled a few women before his marriage. But didn't the great Alexander Pushkin confess that he found the commandment, "Thou shalt not covet thy neighbour's wife," a particularly hard one to keep? And now, 50 years old, a prisoner, almost blind, and obviously doomed to die right here in prison, Spiridon showed no inclination to play the saint, to despond, to repent, or, least of all, to reform. He simply took his busy broom in his hands and swept the yard from dawn to dusk, day in and day out, in a life-and-death struggle against the commandant and the operations officers. Whoever the power-holders were, Spiridon was always at odds with them. What Spiridon loved was the land. What Spiridon possessed was his family. Concepts such as homeland, religion, and socialism, little used in ordinary everyday conversation, might have been completely unknown to Spiridon. His ears were deaf to them. He could not get his tongue around them. To him, homeland meant family. Religion meant family. Even socialism meant family. To all the disseminators of the rational and good and eternal, all the writers who had called Spiridon and his like God-bearers, though he was unaware of it, the priests, the social democrats, the volunteer agitators and professional propagandists, white landowners and red kolkhoz chairmen who had themselves dealt with Spiridon in the course of his life, he had just one angry, but of necessity silent, message. Why don't you all go